So imagine two investors, right? They both pick the exact same winning tech stocks, the exact same reliable government bonds,
Right.
and they hold on to them for the exact same amount of time. But when it's time to cash out, one of them retires with literally millions more than the other.
Wow.
Yeah, and with like half the financial stress along the way. And the crazy thing is, the difference wasn't what they bought, it was the invisible architectural blueprint of, how they mixed those assets together.
Exactly.
So, welcome to this deep dive. Today, our mission is to basically decode the mechanics of asset classes and portfolio diversification. We really want to give you a shortcut to becoming a highly resilient, well-informed investor.
Yeah, because the problem most people face isn't the lack of available investments. It's actually that they treat their financial lives like a junk drawer.
Oh, a junk drawer. I like that.
Yeah. You know, they buy a stock here, they throw some money into a mutual fund over there, maybe buy some crypto just because a friend mentioned it at a party.
Right, totally random.
Exactly. They collect assets randomly without really considering how those individual pieces interact under the hood.
Which brings us to a much better way to visualize this. Like, building a portfolio is a lot like engineering a high-performance car's suspension system.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Right, because you can have a massively powerful engine, and those are your high-growth assets driving you forward. But if you don't install shock absorbers, what happens?
The whole thing falls apart.
Yeah, the very first pothole you hit on the road is just going to tear the chassis apart.
And that structural balance is really the entire point of diversification. In finance, those different parts of the vehicle are your asset classes.
Okay, so define that for us.
So an asset class is just a category of investments that share fundamental characteristics, right? They behave similarly in the marketplace. But more importantly, they often behave inversely to other classes.
So when one zigs, the other zags.
Exactly. When the engine is overheating, the cooling system kicks in. Understanding how to group these investments to manage risk and engineer specific returns is how you actually take control of your financial architecture.
So let's start with the traditional materials, right? Before we build the house, we need to look at the materials. And we don't need to spend time on the basic definitions of a stock or a bond.
Right, most of us know the basics.
Yeah, most of us know the difference between owning a slice of the bakery versus lending the baker money for a new oven. But the actual mechanics of how they interact within that suspension system is where the architecture really
Oh,
happens.
absolutely.
Take equities, for example. We know they are the growth engine. But treating all stocks as one monolithic asset class seems incredibly dangerous.
It is. It's super dangerous. The categorization gets much more granular because the risk profile is just very wild.
Yeah, so.
Well, within equities, you have subclasses based on market capitalization. So you have large cap, mid cap, and small cap. A massive established multinational tech firm is going to react to a sudden global supply chain shock very differently than, say, a small cap domestic startup.
That makes sense.
And you also have the division between growth stocks and value stocks. Growth stocks are companies reinvesting all their capital to expand rapidly.
Right, the high flyers.
Yeah. Whereas value stocks are established companies trading below their intrinsic value that often pay consistent dividends.
So even if your entire portfolio is literally just stocks, you could theoretically build in some shock absorption just by balancing growth with value, or domestic with international.
You could, theoretically.
But ultimately, if the broader stock market crashes, that whole sector generally goes down together, right?
Yes, which is exactly why the traditional blueprint relies so heavily on fixed income bonds. They act as the primary counterweight.
Right.
When you buy a government bond, a corporate bond, or a municipal bond, you are locking in a predictable stream of income.
But I want to push back on this idea of bonds being the perfect shock absorber because, I mean, we've seen periods recently where high inflation and rising interest rates cause both stocks and bonds to drop simultaneously.
Oh, definitely.
Like, if the central bank raises rates to 5%, suddenly newly issued bonds are paying out a lot more than the older ones you're holding, which just crushes their resale value.
Right. That is a critical observation. Because the traditional 60-40 portfolio, 60% stocks, 40% bonds, it relies on the assumption that when equities fall, central banks will lower interest rates to stimulate the economy.
Right. causing bond prices to rise and offset the losses.
Exactly. But when that negative correlation breaks down, as it does in high inflation environments, you see the massive vulnerability of relying purely on paper assets.
And that brings us perfectly to the next major category, cash and real assets.
Right.
Because keeping cash in a money market fund or a CD feels incredibly safe. The nominal value doesn't drop. $100 is $100.
On paper, yes.
But the glaring weakness of cash is inflation. It's just slowly bleeding purchasing power every single day it sits there.
And that vulnerability is exactly why institutions use tangible physical assets to insulate themselves. So real assets include real estate, infrastructure, and commodities like gold, oil, and agricultural products.
So things you can actually touch.
Exactly. And the mechanism here is intrinsic value. Think about it. If you own an apartment building and inflation drives up the cost of living by 10%, what happens?
Everything gets more expensive.
Right. The cost of the raw materials to build a competing apartment building also goes up 10%. Therefore, you can raise rents. And the fundamental value of your asset rises in tandem with inflation.
Oh, wow. So physical assets act as a direct hedge against fiat currency depreciating.
They do. They anchor the portfolio in physical reality. When paper assets become highly volatile, a barrel of oil or a piece of commercial real estate still retains its fundamental utility.
Okay, so we've established the traditional suspension system. We've got stocks for the engine, bonds, and cash for stability, real assets for inflation protection.
Right.
But global markets are evolving super fast. The materials available to a modern investor look very different today than they did, say, 20 years ago.
Oh, completely different.
Yeah, and we are seeing massive macroeconomic shifts creating entirely new categories.
And a phenomenal example of this is the transformation currently taking place in Saudi Arabia.
Really? Tell us about that.
Yeah, this isn't just a regional economic update. It's a structural shift in global market access. Driven by the kingdom's Vision 2023 and Vision 2030 initiatives, Saudi Arabia is actively engineering a transition away from a purely oil-dependent economy.
Right, toward a diversified global financial hub.
Exactly. To do that, they have to attract foreign capital, which means opening up their financial infrastructure.
The text points to the liberalization of the Tadawul, right? The Saudi stock exchange.
Yes.
But how does opening a previously localized exchange actually change the mechanics of investing for someone, you know, sitting thousands of miles away?
Well, it fundamentally changes liquidity and valuation. Historically, restricted markets suffer from a lack of liquidity. There simply aren't enough buyers and sellers moving large volumes of capital.
Which makes prices volatile.
Exactly. And it makes exiting a position difficult. By opening the Tadawul to foreign institutional investors, they are flooding the market with liquidity.
Oh, I see.
For the global investor, this opens up a massive new menu of regional equities that were previously inaccessible. It allows them to capture growth in emerging sectors like Saudi tech, renewable energy, and domestic infrastructure.
It also expands access to Sharia-compliant alternatives, which is super interesting because they operate on a completely different mechanical premise than traditional Western finance.
They really do. It's a fascinating structure.
Let's unpack Sukuk, for example. If Islamic finance strictly prohibits the charging or earning of interest, which is basically the entire foundational premise of a Western bond, how does a fixed income instrument like a sukuk actually function?
That's a great question.
Right. Like, how do you make money if you aren't charging interest on a loan?
It is a brilliant structural workaround. With a traditional bond, you are lending cash to an entity and they pay you back with interest. It's just a debt obligation.
Simple enough.
But with a sukuk, you are not lending money. You are buying a proportional, tangible ownership stake in an underlying asset.
Oh, wait, really?
Yeah. Let's say a government wants to build a new toll road. They issue a sukuk. You buy a certificate, which grants you partial ownership of that physical road.
Oh, so your quote-unquote yield isn't an arbitrary interest rate. It's actually a share of the actual profits or rental income generated by the asset.
Correct. The returns are tied to the performance of a real physical asset rather than just the time value of money.
That makes so much sense.
It provides the predictable income stream of a bond, but structurally, it's an asset-backed investment. This provides an incredible layer of diversification because the risk is tied to the asset's utility, not just the issuer's credit rating.
Man, that shift toward aligning investments with specific principles brings us to another massive emerging category, ESG and impact investing.
Yes, very popular right now.
But I have to play devil's advocate here for a second.
Go for it.
So impact investing vehicles are explicitly designed with a dual mandate. They want to generate financial returns while also creating a positive social or environmental outcome.
Right.
Isn't a fund manager's sole fiduciary duty to maximize return for the investor? If they're compromising potential yield to fund, say, a green energy project, aren't they failing the investor?
That is the traditional critique, absolutely.
Hmm.
But the mechanism of ESG environmental, social, and governance investing has really evolved past mere philanthropy.
How so?
Modern impact investors argue that these factors actually mitigate long-term systemic risk.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, think about it. If you invest heavily in a company with terrible environmental practices, you aren't just ignoring your morals. You are ignoring the massive financial risk of future regulatory fines, carbon taxes, or consumer boycotts.
Ah, so measuring environmental impact is actually just a proxy for measuring long-term corporate sustainability and risk management.
Exactly. The dual mandate doesn't necessarily mean accepting a lower return. It means recognizing that positive environmental and social practices are increasingly correlated with long-term financial stability.
That's a huge shift in perspective. All right, let's move to the bleeding edge of the new assets, the alternative and emerging classes.
The fun stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Because historically, alternatives meant private equity or hedge funds, which required literally millions of dollars just to get in the door.
Totally inaccessible for the average person.
Right. But now we're looking at cryptocurrencies, digital collectibles, and fractional tokenized ownership. And I gotta be honest, I look at tech startups and digital tokens and I just see massive idiosyncratic risk.
Well, sure.
Aren't these emerging assets fundamentally way too unstable for a standard portfolio?
I mean, they carry high volatility, yes.
Right.
And they lack the 50-year track records of blue chip stocks, absolutely. But idiosyncratic risk, the risk tied to one specific company or token, can actually be managed if the access mechanism is structured correctly.
Okay, explain that.
This is where the technological infrastructure has completely revolutionized the asset class. The source material actually highlights platforms like Usul Gamma as a prime example of this evolution.
Okay, let's break down how a platform like that actually alters the risk profile. Because they focus heavily on fractional tokenized ownership in real estate.
Right.
How does taking a physical building and turning it into digital tokens change the math for you, the investor?
Well, think about the traditional barriers to commercial real estate.
Mm.
If you want to buy a high-yield commercial office building, you need millions in capital.
Yep.
You have to lock that money up for years. And if you suddenly need cash, selling the building takes months of legal paperwork, escrows, broker fees. It's a highly illiquid asset.
It's a nightmare if you need cash fast.
Exactly. But with tokenization, that same commercial building's equity is placed on a blockchain ledger and split into thousands of digital tokens.
And that changes everything.
It really does. First, it democratizes access. You can buy a fraction of that building for a fraction of the cost, instantly lowering the barrier to entry.
Wow.
Second, and more importantly for risk management, it creates liquidity. You can trade those tokens on a secondary market in seconds, rather than waiting months to sell a physical property.
So platforms that provide curated access to these tokens basically allow investors to spread their capital across dozens of different properties.
Yes, you're diversifying away the idiosyncratic risk while still capturing that high growth potential.
Okay, so we have a complete view of the available materials now. We have the traditional engine and shocks, the inflation hedging real assets, the newly accessible global markets like the Tata Wool. We've got asset-backed instruments like Sukuk and highly liquid fractional alternatives. But how do we actually assemble the vehicle? Like, how do you architect the specific blueprint for your money?
So the architecture is dictated by four structural pillars that are totally unique to you.
Okay, what's the first one?
First is risk tolerance. You have to be brutally honest about your psychological ability to endure volatility.
Right, don't lie to yourself.
Exactly. If a 20% drop in your portfolio value makes you panic and sell everything, your risk tolerance is low, regardless of what your financial goals are.
The second pillar is the investment horizon, right?
Yes. Time is the most critical variable in the formula.
Because if your goal is buying a house in 2 years, your blueprint absolutely must prioritize capital preservation. A sudden market correction could wipe out your entire down payment.
Exactly. But on the flip side, if you are investing for a retirement that is 30 years away, you actively want exposure to volatility.
Because that's where the growth premium lives, right? You have decades to ride out the cycles.
Precisely. The third pillar is income versus growth. Are you engineering this portfolio to generate a monthly cash yield right now, like relying on bond yields, Sukuk distributions, and dividend stocks?
Or are you aiming for capital appreciation, where the fundamental value of the assets compounds over time without throwing off immediate cash?
Right. And the fourth is economic conditions. Factoring in the macroeconomic reality of inflation, interest rates, and global liquidity, which we discussed earlier.
So taking those four pillars, the text provides specific architectural shapes for portfolios. Let's just describe the shape of these blueprints rather than getting bogged down in the exact math.
Sounds good. So if you fit the conservative profile, meaning short horizon, low risk tolerance, prioritizing preservation, the shape of your portfolio is heavily anchored.
Lots of shocks.
Yes. More than half of your capital is locked into fixed, reliable income like bonds or cash equivalents. You only maintain a thin sliver of equities, just enough to ensure the overall portfolio doesn't lose its purchasing power to inflation.
The engine is small, but the shock absorbers are massive.
Now,
contrast that with the balanced approach. This is the classic even split. You have an equal weight of growth engine, your equities, and stability.
Right.
But notably, the stability isn't just bonds anymore. The blueprint allocates significant portions to real assets and alternatives. It's an all-weather vehicle designed for moderate growth while hedging against both market crashes and inflation spikes.
Then you have the aggressive structure. Long horizon, high risk tolerance. The vast majority of this portfolio is dedicated to the engine equities and high growth alternative assets.
You're just flooring it.
Pretty much. The fixed income portion is stripped down to the absolute bare minimum, just enough to keep the lights on during a severe downturn. You're accepting a highly volatile ride in exchange for maximizing long-term compound growth.
And then integrating those global shifts we talked about, there is the Sharia-compliant blueprint.
Right.
The shape here is so fascinating because it fundamentally replaces Western debt. Instead of traditional bonds, half the portfolio is anchored by Sukuk, those asset-backed profit-sharing instruments.
Exactly. And the rest is distributed across equities, real estate investment trusts, and alternatives. This ensures the entire structure aligns with Islamic finance principles while still capturing both growth and yield. The overarching takeaway here is that no single shape is universally superior. The quote-unquote best portfolio is simply the one that accurately mirrors the specific intersection of your timeline, your psychological risk tolerance, and your financial objectives.
But the architecture doesn't end once the initial build is complete, does it?
Oh, no. Definitely not.
You don't just assemble the car, lock it in the garage, and expect it to run perfectly 30 years later. The environment changes and the components degrade or overperform. So how do we maintain the integrity of the blueprint over time?
Through systematic rebalancing. A portfolio is a living ecosystem. The text recommends a rigorous review every 6 to 12 months or following a major life event.
Okay.
But the actual mechanism of rebalancing is where the real discipline of investing reveals itself.
Let's walk through the math of how that actually works, because it forces you into a behavior that feels deeply counterintuitive.
It really does.
Let's say you built a balanced portfolio, a 60-40 split between stocks and bonds. You experience a massive bull market and your tech stocks double in value.
Okay.
Suddenly, when you look at your portfolio, it isn't 60-40 anymore, because the stocks grew so much faster, they now make up, say, 75% of your total wealth.
Exactly. And most amateur investors look at that and think, great, my stocks are winning, let it ride.
Right, human nature.
But structurally, your vehicle has mutated. You now have a massive engine and completely inadequate shock absorbers. You are drastically overexposed to equity risk right before a potential market correction.
Ah, so to rebalance, you are literally forced to sell off a portion of those winning stocks, capture the gains, and use that cash to buy more of the underperforming bonds, bringing the ratio back to 60-40.
Which perfectly illustrates the genius of the mechanism. Human psychology naturally wants to chase performance.
Right. Oh, totally. Fear of missing out.
Exactly. To buy more of whatever is currently going up and sell whatever is going down. That is exactly how people end up buying at the peak and selling at the bottom.
Rebalancing mathematically forces you to do the exact opposite.
Yes. It enforces a strict discipline of skimming profits off your overvalued assets and systematically buying undervalued assets. It automates the golden rule of investing. Buy low and sell high.
It strips the emotion entirely out of the process. You aren't guessing where the market is going. You are simply maintaining the architectural integrity of your original blueprint.
That is the ultimate difference between gambling and investing. Investing isn't about wildly chasing the newest trend or trying to time the top of the market.
Right.
It is about actively engineering and maintaining a resilient structure that absorbs macroeconomic shocks and relentlessly compounds value over time.
Which brings us to the final thought I want to leave you with today. After everything we've unpacked, from the mechanics of sukuk and tokenized real estate to the mathematical discipline of rebalancing, take a hard look at your own financial life.
Yeah, do an audit.
Log into your brokerage accounts, look at your retirement funds, your crypto wallets, your savings. If a forensic accountant analyzed where your money is sitting right now, what kind of blueprint would they see?
That's a great question to ask yourself.
Would they see a highly deliberate all-weather vehicle engineered to get you exactly where you want to go? Or would they just see a random pile of parts you've accumulated over the years, hoping they somehow assemble themselves into a secure future?
Mm-hmm.
The tools and the materials are all available to you. The global markets are more accessible than ever. It is time to step into the role of the architect. Ensure your blueprint matches your destination.